The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. For many of you, this is our favorite podcast because, we have lots of great guests. Last week we talked to Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum. We've had some fascinating interviews lately, but there's nothing like getting your questions answered, is there? So send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. We'll keep answering as many of them as are appropriate. And for those of you unfamiliar with today's guest, my colleague at the Hoffman Center, Layla Mutin, is a registered dietitian, and she has also earned an advanced master's degree in the field of nutrition with over 15 years of experience in the nutritional field. And how you doing, Layla?
I'm great. I'm cold, but it's February. How are you?
Good, good. So, yeah, actually, the article that I'm writing for this week's newsletter is about how to avoid the winter blahs, or actually not avoid them, but counteract them, because we're deep into the hunger season here in the Northeast.
Yeah.
You know, lots of cold days, lots of snow, and a lot of people suffering from terminal seasonal affective disorder and cabin fever. So we're going to provide some hints to alleviate the pain for those of you who are not listening to us from Florida or Mozambique or Southern California or wherever.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Anyway, 5 more weeks till spring.
Exactly. So It'll be you know, pretty soon we'll be longing for those cold days because usually there's like
I'll take a hot day.
No, there's a really fast transition. You know, there's about like a couple of optimal days, and then there's the dog days start early. Well, whatever.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I was really excited about last week was, you know, we'd been talking about this supposed sting on the supplements undertaken by Attorney General Schneiderman in New York State. And he accused the supplement retailers of marketing basically junk, completely adulterated stuff with virtually no active material, lots of additives and contaminants. And he cited as evidence a test called DNA barcoding, which sounds like, hey, if you watch CSI, that sounds great. DNA, that's where it's at, right? DNA testing, yeah. But there's been some significant blowback. And initially I thought, usually the mainstream media, you know, the big media outlets like the Times and the Post, they tend to drown out dissenting views. You know, we're sort of little pipsqueaks and we sometimes can blog and write. Little articles can appear saying, hey, your argument's full of holes, but the word doesn't get out. But I was very pleased to see some very mainstream publications critique the Attorney General. And I'll just share with you something from last week. The New York, actually a couple of weeks ago, because I only became aware of it a little after it came out. The New Yorker, which is, it's a widely read magazine across the country, The New Yorker. And, you know, I like The New Yorker. The cartoons are great, and the short stories are great. The humor is great. And I really didn't expect to see a reasonable, balanced article about this subject in The New Yorker. So here's, and the headline of the article tells you everything. How not to test a dietary supplement. By a person named Nicola Twilley. I don't know who she is.
I haven't heard of her. Okay.
Let's see what says she is. Hang on, I'm scrolling down to the bottom of the article. Nicola Twilley is the author of the blog Edible Geography, a co-host of the Gastropod podcast, and a contributing writer at NewYorker.com. So she's someone with a little bit of a purchase or understanding of food. So what she has to say is what we've been saying all along. And she articulates it beautifully. She says that the group used a method known as DNA barcoding, which identifies an organism by a small segment of its mitochondrial DNA. So the problem, she says that while DNA barcoding has proved useful in other areas where species identification is necessary, including pest control, bioterrorism monitoring, and it has recently become especially prevalent in food-related inquiries. In other words, if you want to know whether that Chilean sea bass that's sitting on your plate is not, you know, Malaysian catfish.
Oh boy!
You know, which is there's a lot of fraud in the fish industry. So just do the DNA barcoding. It's a standard method for identifying mislabeled fish. Yada yada yada. But there are some problems with the method that the Attorney General's scientists used. First, what we might call the near ingredients, wheat, rice, even wild carrots, are perfectly legal in dietary supplements, provided they're kept below a certain level. And this DNA testing can pick up infinitesimal amounts, you know, so it's not like, you know, there's like massive amounts of wheat or rice in these products. I mean, you know, rice is actually used as kind of a balancer and a filler, and it's pretty neutral. Yeah. Wheat could be a problem for people with celiac disease. However, we didn't know the results of this test. They didn't quantitate it. It might be just an infinitesimal vestige of wheat there, which is far below the threshold that could trigger a celiac disease. So anyway, they also say DNA is very fickle. The heating and irradiation that's part of standard manufacturing of herbal products, which is used to kill potentially harmful microbes, can actually destroy the DNA. Hey, it destroys the microbes, so it can destroy the DNA. And it's a very well-reasoned articles, and there are many articles like this, and I posted them on my Facebook page. Those of you who are on Facebook, it's already buried beneath subsequent posts, but please go back and look at it, and above all, share it with as many people as you can, because a lot of people are reading the wrong information. The Times and the Washington Post have adopted an agenda where this story is very convenient because it undermines the credibility of the supplement industry. And then in the next paragraph, they always write, the supplement industry is unregulated. We need stronger regulations to protect the public from fraud and the danger of these mislabeled supplements, yada, yada. Because they're right there with that agenda. They want more legislation. The FDA should have more power. The supplement industry should.
It's all part of the anti-supplement propaganda machine.
Absolutely. And the agenda is to make supplements like drugs that, you know, you'll have to go humbly hat in hand to the FDA every time you come up with a new supplement and, you know, a bag full of money, because it really costs a lot to do this, and have each and every supplement arduously researched and go through a very, very expensive approval process where you need lawyers and schmoozers. And you know who's in a great position to take advantage of that? Is the Big Pharma. Big Pharma can then just simply take over the supplement industry because they've got those lawyers, schmoozers, regulatory people in place, and they can get it done. So, you know, we got to tell the story. And, you know, so anyway, the story is finally getting out there. And this is going to be a real blowback for the Attorney General. I think his political aspirations will actually be damaged by this, because every Attorney General of the state of New York, you know, they kind of wait it out. And then when the governor retires, loses his mojo, they run for governor. They want to be the governor. And I think, you know, this is something that he's campaigning on to try and show that he is a valiant steward of the public interest, a knight in shining armor. And
but he didn't do his due diligence in this.
No. If it doesn't do his due diligence in this, imagine what he would do as governor. You know, he would launch misguided attacks against various industries in the state of New York. And, you know, this is a little bit what got the previous governor a little bit in trouble. You know, the one who slept with the prostitutes, what's his name?
Elliot Spitzer.
Spitzer. You know, Spitzer was like, you know, he's like a mad dog, very, very aggressive attorney general. And, in certain cases, it's alleged that he jumped the gun. You know, without evidence, he released derogatory information about businesses and Wall Street individuals. Without having done his due diligence to prove the case, and it's sort of like governing by press release rather than through a legislative or judicial process or a scientifically valid process in this case. Anyway, So that's the deal. I feel from the beginning, from the moment this was launched, I remember when I saw this thing come out, I was actually on jury duty, and I was sitting in the jury room, which is boring, and they you wait till you get called. And I'm sitting there, and the good thing about it is now they have Wi-Fi. So I'm sitting there with my iPad, and I'm trying to do my work, and I see these articles appear about how supplements are adulterated. And right away, I said, "Yeah, but what kind of methodology are they using?" And then we had great guests. We had Steve Mister a couple of weeks ago, and we had Mark Blumenthal a couple of weeks ago to tell us that these are experts in the field of supplementation and herbal medicine, pharmacognosy, and they just said, these methods do not pass muster. They're just not correct. So anyway, I didn't want to take away from too many of the questions.
No. It's important to reiterate to listeners that, this is still a topic and there's being blowback, and they did it wrong. Schneiderman did it wrong. So
yeah, and it'll turn out to be, I think, an embarrassment for him.
Yeah.
And but look, how many voters? Let's look at the stats. I think virtually half of people take supplements. And of those,
More than that.
Yeah,
okay, but
let's conservatively estimate half of people take supplements. And in New York is a state where shows like mine have attracted enormous audiences. And my predecessors, Dr. Carlton Fredericks and Dr. Robert Atkins, have had hundreds of thousands of devoted followers and listeners. Mm-hmm. And these are not just people who take supplements. These are partisans of taking supplements. These are people who believe strongly and implicitly in the benefits of supplements. And to disrespect them in this fashion, to tell them that they're just a bunch of idiots, they're boobs, they're being taken in, really, I think, could arouse the ire of lots of New York voters, who say, well, wait a minute, you're poisoning the well of something that's a very, very important part of my lifestyle, and how dare you? How dare you do this?
Mm-hmm. And by a non-scientist, I may say. Yeah.
Right, with a bunch of, aggressive young staffers who think, hey, mm-hmm. we're going to grab some headlines, and then we'll issue a press release. And, of course, all the magazines and newspapers gobbled it up.
I can almost hear, the conversation in the back room. We need to discredit the supplement industry. Find a way to do it. Make it happen.
Yeah, or we need a hot button issue. What's our hot button issue this? Oh, great. We'll talk about fraud in the supplement industry. That sounds like a good one. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've already beaten up on Wall Street enough, and so let's go for the supplement industry.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, anyway, okay. We have a question from Forrest. He has a very interesting question. He's confused over chocolate and fat recommendations. Dr. Hoffman, what's wrong with my use of chocolate? I'm 65 and overweight. I make a daily drink consisting of coffee.
If I might interrupt you.
Yeah.
What's wrong with his chocolate use? Right there. I cited a study on my program a couple of weeks ago where they found that chocolate consumption could reduce the risk of diabetes, but only in normal weight males.
Yes.
And
Forrest heard that. Forrest
right.
heard you talk about that. Mm-hmm.
And he's overweight. So maybe the rules that apply to normal weight males don't apply to overweight males because chocolate adds a caloric burden sure to people who are overweight and might tip the balance towards the thermodynamic equation towards excess calories, not too many calories in, not enough calories out. So it's not something that can magically make the pounds drop off you if you're overweight.
Right, that's true. And I wonder what the rest of Forrest's diet is like.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well,
He's making a daily drink of coffee, Nestle's natural, not processed with alkali, unsweetened cocoa powder, and
good.
Heavy whipping cream.
Okay.
Now, you know, he was wondering, because you were saying not to use fat with the chocolate, but don't we need to use fat to properly utilize the beneficial constituents in things like chocolate?
Right. That's a good question, because, you know, yeah. You might say, why not make just a really low-calorie drink, which probably doesn't taste very good, of coffee. And I do this sometimes. I put unsweetened cocoa in my coffee. I don't know. Sometimes I get a yen for, you know, I'm tired. And by the way, I drink decaf only, because otherwise I guzzle so much decaf that I would be vibrating if it was all caffeinated coffee. So I just love the flavor of coffee. It turns out there may be some benefits to coffee, and it's not about the caffeine, the polyphenols in the dark coffee beans. But anyway, so I throw in some...
You get some potassium there, too.
Right. Yeah. So I throw in some unsweetened cocoa. But frankly, it's pretty raw tasting. There's a huge difference between the flavor of that and the flavor of See's candies or something. Or,
sure,
you know,
sure.
You know, Mars bar, because that's just loaded with sugar and fat. Now, he's adding the whipped cream.
He's adding the unsweetened cocoa powder that is not processed with alkali.
Okay.
Which is kind of what you want to do, but let's talk a little bit about the alkali, the Dutching process of cocoa.
Okay.
Cocoa is actually frequently Dutched. It's treated with alkali because what it does is changes the taste by reducing bitterness. It also increases the dispersibility of cocoa powder for various applications, such as making beverages.
And you know what's interesting is the Dutch probably figured this out really early on, like maybe in the 1600s, because they, you know, chocolate comes from the Indies. I mean the East Indies, you know, where they had colonies in Indonesia, mm-hmm. And so they probably brought it over and they made it into a much more palatable, delicious drink by Dutching it. I guess that's where the term Dutching the chocolate originated, because they were premier chocolate makers.
Mm-hmm. This treatment with alkali is almost a 200-year-old process. Well, here's the bottom line on that alkali treatment. Because it's light, it's normally a light alkali treatment, it's only reducing the beneficial polyphenols, the beneficial antioxidants, by only about 40%. So it's not bad. It's the ones that are highly treated with a lot of alkali, and that's normally not done with chocolate. So the ORAC value is pretty much okay.
That's the process.
Yeah.
What does that mean? The ORAC value? I forget.
The ORAC value, the antioxidant value.
Okay.
The antioxidation. The antioxidation of efficacy of that particular food or product, yeah.
Great. So
the total polyphenol content.
So the question I have is, how do we know when people are buying even dark chocolate, whether it's alkali treated or Dutched or not? Because
it's supposed to say, in the U.S. food labeling regulations say that alkalized cocoa powder or liquor must be declared as cocoa treated with alkali.
Okay.
Now, in the rest of the world, that can be different.
Mm-hmm.
So, but here, it should say that, treated with alkali.
Okay. So, so now, what I've read is that milk chocolate is virtually worthless when it comes to the polyphenols, because there's something about mixing the chocolate with the milk that renders it virtually without benefit. The same thing I've heard with tea is that you actually vitiate the benefits of dark tea when you drink it with milk. That may mean why are the English so relatively unhealthy, because they always have tilk tea with milk. But what this guy is doing, Forrest is doing, is he's adding heavy cream, and I guess he's following like an Atkins like principle. He doesn't want to add skim milk to his cocoa, because you know it's more carbohydrates than fat. He wants to put fat in there for satiety value. But maybe that is interfering with the health benefits, no?
That's true. I would think so.
Yeah.
I would question the rest of his diet as well, since he's overweight. So.
But
your dentist, if you go to your dentist, your dentist will tell you, oh, your teeth are stained. Are you a coffee drinker? Are you a tea drinker? Put milk in it, especially tea. Put milk in it so as to try to counteract that. But
so to interfere with it. You know, I tell you, I run the risk of a lot of staining because I drink lots of coffee, but decaffeinated coffee, and I eat a lot of dark chocolate, and I have a lot of berries, you know, and to me, the staining, I'd love to stain all my cells with these beneficial polyphenols. I hope that I'm, like, internally stained, seriously stained, because that can confer benefit. I mean, and also, sure. Drinkers of tea, and I don't like tea, but drinkers of tea have remarkable protection against dental caries, as well as periodontal disease and mouth cancer, because you literally apply these polyphenols to the oral cavity and the teeth and the gums, and there are beneficial effects there, too.
Yeah. Forrest, we hope we've answered your question.
Good.
All right.
So take time to answer another one.
Okay, we have one from Carol. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Dr. Steven Sinatra, the prominent integrative cardiologist who's been in your podcast in the last year or so, recently stated that...
And we published some of his articles.
On the website.
Yeah, right.
That he says that based on the latest science, postmenopausal women should only take about 100 milligrams of supplemental calcium a day. I would like your take on this, as well as the latest recommendations of many practitioners to include K2 and, of course, vitamin D.
Okay. Well, I think there's a point to be made there, but I think that this is a controversy. And there are some indications that high doses of calcium in supplemental form, not so much dietary form, are associated with a higher risk of coronary calcifications, which leads to atherosclerosis and heart disease and stroke. However, most of those studies are by a guy who's really an anti-supplement guy. He's actually written about the lack of efficacy of vitamin D. He's written, you know, so he has a little bit of a horse in the race to discredit the use of supplementation. Other studies have shown that calcium has no impact. Supplemental calcium has no impact on cardiovascular risk. So what I have done, and I've done this, I already did this years and years ago, I made a supplement called OsteoSupport, which is our osteoporosis supplement. And when I first came out, this must have been like 12, 15 years ago, a lot of people said, well, there's just not enough calcium in this. You need 1,200 milligrams of calcium daily to have good bones. And I said, no, what you need is you need some bioavailable calcium. I put 350 in there for four capsules. 350 is, you know, that's not that much. And it was designed to be used in conjunction with the foundation formula, which then had, I think, about 300 milligrams of calcium, so it's 750. And people said, well, that's still not enough. And I said, no, that's plenty. And it's not how much you get, it's how much you absorb and how much you put to use. So the vitamin D helps to put it to use, and the vitamin K helps to put it to use. And
I'm actually writing about that in the newsletter in two parts, the truth about bone health.
Okay.
That it's not all about the calcium. There's vitamin D, there's magnesium, there's vitamin K, there's omega-3s, all of the above. So it's been an oversimplification. And, yes, when you take calcium without enough vitamin K or vitamin D, there could be a problem. Not to mention constipation.
Right.
That's another thing.
Right.
Too much calcium will turn the stool into concrete. So anybody out there who's taking all this calcium and wondering why they're constipated, that is typically the answer. So normally it's balanced with magnesium in that regard.
Right. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that the body regulates the amount of calcium it absorbs. Really, we only absorb about 1/7 the amount of calcium that we take in dietarily. And there are mechanisms by which the body either accesses or doesn't access the calcium that's there. So you could, you know, eat enough calcium to stop up, you know, a sewer line in New York City, you know, one of those, you know, those 12-foot wide sewer lines, main sewer lines. But and it won't absorb it all. But there is a condition where taking too much calcium has actually gotten people into trouble. It was pretty common in the 50s. You know, the show Mad Men is...
Oh, yeah.
Before they had acid-blocking drugs, these powerful targeted acid-blocking drugs, they used to use calcium carbonate to treat ulcers. And all these guys were high-pressure guys. They drank, they smoked. These guys had ulcers. So what they would drink is they'd drink these calcium carbonate drinks, and they would also have like a bottle of milk sometimes in their drawer. You know, so after a meeting with a tough client, they would swig down some antacid, or they would swig down some milk to settle their stomachs because they didn't have these powerful drugs. And they developed excess calcification throughout their bodies. They developed something called milk alkali syndrome. And the calcium would deposit in their joints. Wow. It would deposit in their kidneys and cause painful kidney stones and damage the kidneys. So that you actually can sometimes force too much calcium into your system. That's where it gets to be problematic. Can it cause heart disease? I think that remains controversial. I think it makes for a compelling story.
Yeah.
But we don't yet know the definitive answer on this. Studies kind of fall on both sides of this calcium controversy, and I don't think people should abandon calcium supplementation because of a couple of studies that suggest it is associated with heart disease.
Yeah.
Other studies
but
suggest
we're
no.
We're no longer making the recommendation of 1,200 calcium.
No, we've scaled back. Okay. We've scaled back, but I won't say, you know, cut out calcium, or, you know, if you have heart disease, don't take calcium. I think men may need less calcium than was once thought, too. But men, you know, obviously can get osteoporosis, so we don't want to go into negative calcium balance.
There was one particular study, and this is back when I was in grad school. I remember my professor talking about it, that calcium may be... calcium supplementation for men may be a detriment to the prostate.
Hmm.
I don't remember the details of this.
Well, what is pretty clearly potentially harmful for the prostate, and I have the study like right on my desk here, mm-hmm. There's an association between dairy consumption and prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to pull a study. Here it is. Dairy products, calcium, and prostate cancer risk. Actually, it talks about calcium, too. The conclusion of the study was that high intakes of dairy products, milk, low-fat milk, cheese, and total dietary and dairy calcium, but not supplemental calcium, may increase total prostate cancer risk. So it's the dairy calcium, not the supplemental calcium in this study. So,
wow.
Yeah. So taking a calcium supplement isn't going to cause prostate cancer, but getting a ton of dairy for men may increase the risk of prostate cancer, possibly for hormonal reasons, possibly.
Exactly. I was going to say, how do they ferret out whether it's the calcium that's making that impact?
No, it's not.
Whether the fact that dairy is just such an insulin trigger.
Exactly. It's
or
probably
the hormones.
It's probably not the calcium. And it could be the galactose, which is one of the sugars of milk. You know, milk is a lactose, which is a two-sugar disaccharide, and it's galactose and glucose. Glucose, of course, pure sugar, and galactose is a strange kind of sugar which has been associated with inflammation to some degree, but also with a higher risk in women of ovarian cancer, and that may be the problem. Is the galactose? The galactose may be too much in the way of dairy. So anyway, all right, we got to go to a break because we divide these podcasts into two parts. Good questions. And what's coming up in part two?
Xylitol use in children.
Okay. Xylitol use in children. Well, as long as your child is not a Cocker Spaniel, I guess it's okay. All right. We'll tackle that question in just a moment. Stay tuned for part two of today's Q&A with Layla. I hope you'll join us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.